You're listening to The Head Trash Show with the founder of Head Trash, Alexia Leachman. Head Trash is the home to the new and unique Head Trash Clearance Method that removes unwanted negative thoughts, feelings, and emotions quickly and effectively so that you can achieve clarity, confidence, and contentment in your life. Tune in every week as Alexia shares insights and simple strategies to help you create some headspace to experience confidence and clarity in your life and business. To find out how to clear your head trash quickly and effectively using our unique method, pop over to www.headtrash.co.uk to get our free download and subscribe for our free head trash clearance updates. And now for the show.
Hello and welcome back to the Head Trash Show. This is me, your host, Alexia Leachman. Thank you so much for joining me today. Now on today's show, I've got a fabulous, fabulous episode for you. Today, I will be sharing an interview that I did with Kevin Lay. Now, if you don't know who Kevin Lay is, listen up. Kevin Lay is one of the Jedi Masters of the personal change industry. He's got a very busy practice on Harley Street in London and works frequently with the rich and the famous, including people like Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, and Kevin Spacey. So how wow is that? I hope that goes some way in apologising for my little absence for a couple of weeks. I have to hold my hand up and say, yes, I was drowning. I've got two podcasts right now and it's way too much. Because we had Easter holidays, goddamn. We had Easter holidays and the nursery is closed on a Friday and a Monday, which are my big podcasting days, and I just couldn't get two podcasts out. And on top of that, I also was in the middle of relaunching the Head Trash website. So you can now check out the new Head Trash website. It's looking all new, shiny and brand new and sparkly and all that kind of stuff. So do have a look. But that is why I just simply couldn't get my Head Trash Show podcast. So I really do apologise. And if you were sort of hanging on to your phones wondering where on earth my Head Trash Show was, then that is where it was. I'm sorry, I'm not superhero. I'm not superhuman. And I just couldn't do it. So anyway, that's out of the way. And now back to today's show. Now I'm really, really excited about this interview that I did with Kevin. I did it a while ago. And Kevin and I tried to talk for a number of times. We actually did an interview on Skype, but the sound was just so terrible that I thought I just couldn't possibly use it. So we ended up meeting in person. And so when you hear the conversation that we had, we're literally in the same room together. But interestingly, the microphone didn't quite perform as I'd hoped. I thought live would mean it would be really crystal clear. My voice is kind of crystal clear. But his is less so. And I don't know why that is, because we were both sitting the same distance away from the mic. It's probably me and my muppeteering around the mic. So I do apologise over that. But so just little turn it up a little bit so you can really hear what Kevin's got to say, because Kevin, during our chat, really does share some amazing stuff, some great stories, some really interesting stuff around the techniques that he uses. So just some of the things that he's going to talk about include, you know, about the heart, why the heart is the real brain, why we don't see more evidence and research to support some of the personal change techniques that are used a lot by people that work in the personal development industry, why cognitive behavioural therapy, CBT, is used as the go-to technique by health professionals, and why actually this is failing many people. He also shares a couple of really brilliant techniques, for one for clearing anxiety and panic attacks. It's just so simple and quick that it's a really useful one to listen out for, and another one for stimulating oxytocin. So that's a really good one as well for combating stress. And he also shares a lot about his new CyTap technique that basically blends the best of all the techniques that he's trained in, and he's trained in a fair ton of stuff. So he is a master NLP practitioner, also hypnosis. He's trained in EMDR. He was the first certified trainer in havening, which is an amazing technique as well that's got a lot of science to back it up. So there's a lot of stuff that he talks about during our chat. For the professional coaches and therapists out there, I think that you are going to love this episode to get a real insight into one of the leading lights of the industry and how he approaches the work that he does. And for those of you that aren't a professional in this industry, I think you'll learn a lot from just listening to what Kevin has got to say about personal change as well. It really is a fabulous interview, and I'm enormously grateful to Kevin for coming to my house. I mean, goodness, I can't believe that, you know, he's worked with these rich and famous people and he's come to my house. So there was a lot of cleaning going on before he turned up, let me tell you. So I hope that you enjoy the interview that I had with Kevin, and he also shares a great offer for people as well. So if you, once you listen to this, you'll find out what you need to do to get a free audio session from Kevin as well. So listen up. I hope you enjoy it. It's a bit longer than usual, the interview, but you know what? It's Kevin Lay, and you just got to listen to what he's got to say because it's just so brilliant. Hope you enjoy the time that I chatted to Kevin Lay all about loads of stuff. So here's the time that I spoke to him. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to the Head Trash Show, Kevin. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Now, the thing about you, Kevin, is you've got so much wonderful experience and broad experience in the world of personal development, healing, clearing head trash on all sorts of scales that I think it'd be really great for the listeners to understand a little bit more about your journey to how you came to do all this stuff and what you currently do now.
Okay, it started a long time ago. I've got a mixed background, ex-military, I worked in Hollywood for a year. I got into corporate. I was in corporate for a long time. Did very, very well. Ended up as acting chief executive of a multinational. 2000, I got quite ill, and somebody taught me some self-hypnosis to help with some pain and some anxiety and stress issues. And I found out it worked, even though I was very, very skeptical. So I then went to training in hypnosis. And then once I got that skill, I started to do a little bit of coaching along with that, using my corporate knowledge along with the hypnosis patterns. I then, fortunately, in a moment of good luck, met my good friend and, well, probably one of my closest friends now, Paul McKenna. Paul persuaded me to go and train at NLP. I'd read all the books and thought I knew all about it, and then went and did a full NLP course and realised that you do, like these things, have to experience them. I then started to do coaching, quit corporate world, and then became a full-time sort of coach, mentor, did some mentorship work for the Prince's Trust and various other programs like that. Worked some big companies. I did Northern Foods, Toyota, BMW, got some big contract work, and was doing quite well. And then Paul, again, we did a workshop one weekend, which was clearing phobias. We did about 150 between us one weekend.
Wow.
We never did it again for obvious reasons. We were exhausted. We actually became phobic at doing phobia workshops. So we just never did repeat it. We might do one day. And at the end of it, Paul just said, you know, why aren't you doing therapy? I said, do you think? He went, oh, for God's sake, yeah, do it. And then he started to send me people, and then this is when I was still living in Nottingham, and then he nagged me to go and work in London because he had lots of people down there for me to work with. So I did, and then I ended up in Harley Street with a very nice room there, and I've been there now for 14, 15 years. Built up a very good practice, learnt lots of things. You know, I'm a bit of a learning machine, learn all the time. I'm always going on courses. Even going on courses this year, I've already been on one. I've got another couple scheduled. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of them is actually a stand-up comedy course.
Oh, really?
A four-day stand-up course, which is going to be a lot of fun. Because, yeah, you're presenting, you're talking to people. It's just another skill set to have there. Mm. Not that I want to be a comedian, but, you know, who knows? But a lot of people do, actually. Rod Gilbert, who went through the same company I went through, Rod's an NLP master practitioner.
Is he?
And uses a lot of it in his...
I love Rod Gilbert, he's brilliant.
He uses a lot of NLP, a lot of nested loops in the way he does stuff. Quite a few of them have done NLP and a few other things. So yeah, and I'm always looking to sort of develop and create, and I like the Japanese Kaizen philosophy, you know, they're good, make better, just, you know, continuous improvement, develop all the time. Very passionate about my work. Niches, I'm really passionate about creating niches. My first niche when I started in therapy was phobias and smoking. One, because I was a phobic of wasps, really bad, and nothing fixed it. CBT, NLP, TFT, hypnosis, nothing fixed it. I then learned TFT, which is my first energy modality, and killed my phobia in about a minute.
Just
bust it. And that was what convinced me. I fixed up a trauma that had bothered me for some years as well, again on the same morning that I did the phobia. I thought, okay, that's two things in one morning, that's quite impressive when nothing else has touched this. I need to go and learn this. So I went and learned TFT. I became a very close friend of Roger Callahan, the guy that created it. Roger mentored me personally. I then trained Paul in the technique, and along with Roger, and that became my prime modality and my new, if you like, niche, because I could pretty much deal with most things then, but it became speed.
Right, okay.
One session, you're in, done, out. Mm. Finished, all over. So you know, you come with the trauma, you're in, we deal with it and you're gone. And I did really well with a mix of that. And I'm learning other things. I was doing EMDR and IEMT and eye movement stuff, and I say I keep learning. I'm going to do, I think the next one I'm going to be doing is quantum touch.
Okay.
Whether I use it or not, I don't know, but I'll just go and learn about it.
Yeah.
So I learn these things and I use what's useful, and you know, I don't what isn't. It's an interesting journey, and you know, it's I'm still not there yet. It's always, you know, always moving forward. The last thing I learned officially last year was the Havening technique. Paul called me and sort of said, "You need to meet this guy, Ron Rudin." I went, "Okay, why?" And he said, "Well, he's got this technique and you get really good results." And kind of arrogantly, I said to Paul, "I already get really good results. Why do I need this too? Well, just do it." So he nagged a little bit, and I met Ron, and we got on philosophically initially very, very well. And I became the world's first trainer of Havening, one of the earliest certified practitioners. And in fact, I think to this day, I've still probably certified more people globally than anybody in Havening.
Mm.
But a few things didn't align with me, so I sort of stepped out of the ring, and then thought, well, I can complain about all this stuff, or I can do something about it. And why don't I just create my own technique? Why do I keep delivering other people's stuff really well?
Mm.
And everybody, and I mean everybody, was saying, just create your own thing, do your own thing. You've got all this knowledge, all this information. Put it to good use. So I did, using a combination of sort of, you know, electronics theory. And I hate the, everybody sort of jumps on the quantum physics bandwagon, but there is, you know, toroid field stuff based around, and all this is evidence based, and we can measure it using HeartMath. I'm one of the few trainers in the world of HeartMath now. So we've now actually got an evidence base behind the techniques that I've put together. There's an old plaque outside the Royal Society of Medicine in London from Newton that says, the reason I can see so far is because I stand on the shoulders of giants. And that's kind of what I've done. I've kind of climbed up on the shoulders of, you know, Callahan, Bandler, Grinder. And I've trained all the NLP key people. And looked and seen what I can see for myself. And combining that with lots of other knowledge that's out there, just put together and creating my own techniques, which are very rapid, very fast, very unique. Just developed a system that I think is revolutionary in that, one, it's quick, it quantifies and justifies what everybody else is saying, and also fills in lots of gaps. It kind of crosses over that combination between the energy medicine and the bio side of it, and the neurochemical, neurological side of it. It kind of mixes all the three together and pulls all the relevant parts, along with using, as I say, the HeartMath, heart rate variability, to show that what we're doing is working. It's creating coherence and it's creating stability within the body field. And once you have that, you heal faster. You stay healed. You look after yourself better. The body's not in chaos. It's coherent. And when it's coherent like that, you're going to have far less problems than when, you know, there's chaos running through your energetic and your neurotransmitter facilities in your body. So it's...
Well, you've just talked about so much, and I just have so many questions I want to ask you. So first of all, you've just hinted that you've come up with a new approach, blended it all together, that touches on the neuro piece, the quantum piece, the energy medicine piece. So just quickly give us a, like, is this the new CyTAP approach that you've... Is that what it is?
I mean, I've always kind of taught TFT my own way a little bit, but I pretty much stuck to the program purely out of respect for Callahan, who's the genius that did create it. However, Roger died November 4th a couple of years ago, and that kind of opened the doorway a little bit for me to go, okay, I can do my own thing now. Mm. I just didn't before out of respect, because he was a great man of genius. I loved him dearly. So I've kind of pushed the boundaries on TFT a little bit in that we do remote work, and we do remote tapping, where you actually don't even need to tap anybody. You can just look at somebody and fix it.
Okay.
And that's using sort of what they call toroid field. Now, toroid field, it sounds all very sort of woo-woo and fantasy work. Well, every generator on the planet is a toroid field. The Earth's magnetic core is a toroid field. The Big Bang, the universe, is a toroid field. Your heart generates a toroid field that's measurable with HeartMath using a magnetometer. And the heart field measures out about 3 feet. The one from the brain measures out about 2 to 3 inches. And that's not the limit of the heart or the brain field. That's just the limit of the equipment that's able to measure them at the moment. You know, it's way bigger, but we just can't measure that. So that's the limitation of the technology metrics rather than the actual physicality of what's happening. So kind of blending all these techniques and looking at the neurobiology that Ron came up with, the havening, and some of it makes sense, some of it doesn't. And there were missing pieces. Okay, let me just pull all this apart and let me repackage it. Let me put it back together. It's like, you know, throwing a jigsaw, getting 3 or 4 jigsaws and sort of throwing them on and getting all the pieces and just making up a new jigsaw and saying, look at that picture.
Yeah.
And creating something, you know, but it's not chaos, there's order to it.
Mm.
So it's putting, and then looking at some of my own techniques, again, sort of speed-based, using what they call a Lemnis gate, which is the figure of eight. Basically, it's a cross-section of a toroid or a generated field or a magnet or any electromagnetic field. So again, this is hardcore physics. This is energy. It's, you know, any engineer, any physicist will sort of say, well, yeah, of course. You know, once, the moment you start to transfer it across to it, using it as a healing modality, then they go a bit shy on you. But the techniques work. And the difference is now is we can use things like an electrician's voltmeter. So if somebody's bodily or physiological a reverse polarity, then we can measure that and it will show negative millivolts. We then do a very, very simple technique and then put the voltmeter back on and it will show positive millivolts. Now, that's empirical. There's no... The machine doesn't care.
No.
It's not trying to convince you. It's not trying to sell you anything. It's not trying to sort of say... It's just numbers. It's a number generator.
Yep.
So once we kind of get into this state of, okay, here's some evidence base, and then the other thing that you can't fake, you can't control your heart rate to that degree or how it's going to perform, is heart rate variability. HeartMath have done 20-odd years worth of research, tens of thousands of cases, you know, millions of dollars have been put into this. It's used by the US military, it's used by hospitals, by sports people. Everybody knows, you know, medics in the UK now accept HeartMath as a valid metric, as a valid measurement. George Malik, who's the head of cardiology at St George's Hospital in London, Professor Malik, says that heart rate variability is the biggest and most accurate predictor of morbidity and mortality. And it will tell you that you're going to die before anything else does. All these people that literally just have left ventricular hypertrophy, collapse in the street or collapse on a sports field, if they had their HRV done frequently, they'd see that happening and they wouldn't die.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very powerful tool. And again, you know, it's a machine. It's a computer program. It's software. It doesn't care. It's just going to report back what it sees or what the sensors pick up. So the evidence base is there. And to me, evidence is being able to do the same thing over and over and over again and expect and obtain the same results. And if you don't get the same outcome, there's a reason why. Dig into it, find out why, correct it, and then get the same outcome. And we can do that for the first time. You know, we can actually do that. So, you know, we can head off the placebo arguments as well. Of course, you get that too.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a placebo effect in everything. Placebo is the most tested drug on the planet and the most actually efficacious drug on the planet. But you can't sell a drug called placebo.
No.
How bizarre is that?
So you're saying that a lot of the work you've combined and brought together in your new methodology is sort of, you can really stack it up with the science.
It's other people's work. I've looked at the science behind it. I come from a sort of science engineering background, so I've kind of looked at the science and structure behind that and sort of said, okay, you know, here's the theory. How can we prove the theory? And double-blind studies don't do that. I mean, for example, with havening, or even tapping, which implies sort of tapping or touching on the body or stroking on the body, you know, the initial question, okay, how many times did you touch them, how hard did you do it? There are too many variables.
Mm.
Whereas when you just put a probe on somebody and it says an X number or Y number, and then you actually do a very, very small treatment and then repeat the exact same process and you get a different number,
mm.
you can't argue with that. The machine, like I say, doesn't care.
Mm.
When you wire somebody up, the plethysmographic output has been taken through an ear sensor, put through some software in the machine, and it shows what the heart rate data is, and it shows the coherence values, and it gives you all the numbers and all the relative data. You can't fake that.
Mm.
You can't pretend what the data is or what it isn't. And once you can start to replicate this over and over again, it's not just a one-off, it's not a trial of one. There's going to be hundreds of, with heart method, thousands of people have been through this process.
So it's
proven technology. We're just using it as a known, acceptable metric to measure the efficacy of our treatments and what we're doing.
Well, there's a great app that I'm a real fan of called BreatheSync. I don't know if you're aware of it.
Yeah.
It's aware on the Apple.
Yeah.
And I use that before and after when I do head trash clearance using reflective repatterning, mm-hmm. and I always see a massive improvement in the results. And I love that because of the very reason that you just said, you can measure it, you can see it in numbers.
Yeah.
My phone doesn't care what technique I'm using,
exactly.
but I get to see that all the time that I'm getting an impact. So this is brilliant that that what you're bringing together has got all this science backed behind it. Now, just thinking about the science and, the techniques, some of you've touched on, some of the energy and medicine and also things like NLP. A lot of people just sort of throw a lot of those techniques out, considering them woo-woo because there is a lack of science. What do you say to people that go, hey, does this stuff really work?
Well,
why is there no science for it?
My thing is prove it. One is it costs money.
Mm.
Evidence-based studies cost money. Steve and myself have put together a program of an app that's going through clinical trials. We spent 8 years now nearly doing it to the cost of probably a couple hundred thousand pounds, which we're either going to make some money out of, hoping it works, or we're not. And we've written that off. So a lot of the thing is a lot of people will not invest.
Mm.
Yeah, drugs companies have set the bar on this and they can invest millions in a drug and create the study. So that sadly, they control the trial, the ethics committees. We couldn't even call our system exam stress.
Mm.
We had to call it exam nerves, because the moment we put the stress word in there, the S word in there, we have to go through a completely different set of ethics committees.
Right.
So it's very manipulative. So that's why we kind of picked our fights and picked our trials. But now we've got people on side. We've got a study over the last 6 years that's been run at a surgery, which shows that 90% of people that go on the system get a 70% reduction in stress and anxiety in less than 15 minutes.
Wow.
And it's maintained after 6 months, so it has what they call long-term good effect.
Mm.
So again, the study work's been done. Most people don't do it because it's laborious and it's lazy and they can't be bothered a lot of the time.
I mean, going through the process of actually de-stressing what they need to do.
Because, again, not having to go to the pharmaceuticals, but they've kind of set the bar and they've set a very high bar, so very few people can challenge them.
Mm.
And they are not going to challenge things that aren't a threat. I mean, CBT is known to have a very, very poor efficacy. Professor Leo's study showed that with combat stress, I think the results were over a year that 15% had a good outcome, which means an 85% failure rate. That's huge.
Mm.
So why are the drugs companies not having a go at CBT? Because it doesn't work, and within 18 to 24 months, people are back on the medication.
Mm.
So there's no threat there, so that's why. We've already been pre-warned that once we start to get our numbers together and we extrapolate what we've already got, that the farmers will come after us, the pharmaceuticals will come after us. And they'll do one of two things. They'll either offer a silly amount of money to buy the product and bury it, or they'll do everything they can to trash it, us and everything. So we kind of prep for that, but we have a plan. So
good for you.
It's okay.
So basically, what I'm hearing is that, essentially there's a lot of really good techniques out there that can do really good work in reducing stress and helping us to relieve things like depression or anxiety that don't see the light of day because the farmers have got the upper hand in terms of the science.
Absolutely.
And the scientists are paid by the farmers. And so unless someone's going to come up with a ton of money to put research into the stuff that you can't sell in the same way, that's why we don't see it.
Yeah, exactly.
So what about those people that go, they kind of get hung up about wanting to see the science. And, I've certainly come across people where, they go, well, where's the science with what you're using? It's like, well, why don't you just give it a shot?
Here's an interesting one. Let me tell you a story. I did a talk for the British Dental Association from some years ago. And on the talk, I was talking about needlephobics and dentalophobics and how to, those kind of patients. And I did a couple of demonstrations, fixed one guy's fear of heights, who's a dentist. I mean, how I get invited to these things, I don't know, but I do sometimes. And at the end of the night, there's a professor there who was a maxillofacial surgeon. He did maxillofacial surgery. He was a qualified dentist, but he was retired. And he said to me, he says, yes, it's all well and good, he said, but my thing is chocolate. He says, I like chocolate. I eat too much of it. My cholesterol's too high. I should know better. I'd love to control chocolate, but I don't think I can. So I thought, okay, here's an opportunity. I said, okay, well, just imagine eating some chocolate now. He went, yeah, I could do that. I said, how much do you want it right now? He went, ooh, 10, definitely. Yummy. And I knew profiteroles were coming. So I said, okay, just do this. We did a little TFT tapping exercise. I said, okay, imagine trying to eat the chocolate now. And he went, and you could see the discomfort on his face. And he went, well, yeah, I don't want it right now. He said, but I could eat it. I said, but a moment ago, on your desire scale, your lust scale, it was a 10, and now it's more of a disgust scale, and I think it's probably way less. And he went, well, yes, I don't want it right now, but I could eat it. I went, yeah, okay. I said, look, I could get this pen out of my pocket and push it through my eyeball into my brain, but I don't particularly want to. I said, okay, so what you're looking for, Professor, is some evidence, some empirical... So I went, okay, judging by your age, if you don't mind me asking, do you have children? Yes. Do you have grandchildren? I said, well, yes, okay. Do you love your grandchildren? Well, of course I do. Like it was the most banal question on the planet. I said, well, okay, let me ask you something about the love you have for your grandchildren. What colour is it? And he went, sorry? I said, no, what colour is it? Is it red, black, green, blue? He went, well, I said, okay, forget that. What shape is it? Is it cubed, sphere, square? Is it a flat line? I mean, what's the shape of this thing that you call up? He said, sorry, if that's it, let's measure. How do you measure it? Do you measure it in percentage, kilopascals, joules, nanometers, square feet? How do you measure this thing called love? And you see the room's kind of like, oh, geez, he's got us here. And I said, look, I'll tell you what, just wheel in here in a wheelbarrow this thing that you have called love, point at it and say, that's what it is. Show me the evidence. Do a Jerry Maguire thing. Show me the money. And then I'll believe. Otherwise, it's just... And he went... Okay, you just went very quiet. And that's the thing, God, we live, die, and learn for love. And yet there is no evidence. There's none. There's a great phrase that Callahan used to sort of say, the definition of a thought field is a thought field is an invisible structure in space that has an effect on matter. Well, change the word thought field to gravity. Gravity is an invisible force in space that has an effect on matter. Love is an invisible force in space that has an effect on matter. God is an invisible force in space that has an effect on matter. You just change the word over. So where does it all start and where does it all end? Mm. That's the thing. We actually know that. It's actually a white hole and a black hole at the centre of what's called the vertex in the singularity that started the Big Bang. So we've got the quantum theory there to support it.
So we're basically waiting for the science to catch up with... Exactly. Being able to measure these concepts, so measuring the amount of love, measuring a feeling, measuring the intensity of a feeling. Mm-hmm. Once they can start to do that, we can maybe start seeing some evidence that can support and show that this kind of work does.
It is. What's very interesting, I created a technique based on what we call a lemniscate. A lemniscate is the figure of eight, it's the lazy eight, it's the infinity symbol, which is a cross section of an electromagnetic field. Mm. It's the donut to sort of chop through. I was at a dinner party a while ago, and at the dinner party was a friend of mine who's a neurosurgeon. And I'm sat there and I was talking about havening and some of the science and the theory, and he went, some of it I'm not sure about. What about oxytocin and what about a few other things? Actually, talking about oxytocin, I said, I've just developed this technique, and let me show you what I think. And it's literally tracing a figure of eight on your forehead. You put your fingertips in the middle of what you would have as your forehead, and you literally trace this figure of eight, nice, gentle, sort of slow, lazy, a little bit of pressure. And I said, people feel really relaxed. And he went, this is a consultant neurosurgeon who's very left brain, very linear thinking. And he went, well, of course it will. And I went, why? I said, well, you're releasing oxytocin. He says, you're applying force to the third eye. You're going cross hemispheric, so you're going across the corpus callosum to each hemisphere, applying pressure. He says, so there's cross-hemispheric conflict and balance at the same time happening. He said, the very fact you're stroking is going to activate the pituitary and the pineal gland, and you're going to release oxytocin. Oxytocin is the natural antidote to cortisol. Of course you're going to feel relaxed. And I'm sitting there thinking, I can't believe I'm hearing this from a consultant. And he's like, yeah, yeah. He said, look, he said, we do woo-woo too. We just can't talk about it.
Mm,
he said, I understand it. He said, yeah. He said, it's a fascinating technique. Let me know how you get on. So I'm in dialogue with him on maybe looking at that. And I think maybe if we get enough of an evidence base there for him, he might be able to justify getting some fMRIs done, which they have at his hospital, and just see what's happening in the brain. Mm. So again, we can quantify this one. Because we said, look, when that happens, the amygdala fires up when we do this. Oh, look, it calms down. And again, using the heart mass system, which is a correlation of the autonomic nervous system, sympathetic and parasympathetic, once we get those in balance, again, it's the foot on the gas, foot on the brake, speed the heart up, slow it down, and all the other things that happen. Then we just look at what's happening in the body, and then what can we do to kind of basically mess up. So if the body's creating a program that creates anxiety, how can we wreck the program so it can't create anxiety anymore? And that's kind of what we're doing. It's as simplistic as that, really. But measure it. That's the key thing. It's not just sort of say, okay, what's your SUD value now? It was a 10, is it now? Now it's a 2. And have the detractor say, well, that's just a placebo. You just made them feel better temporarily, or it's a distraction or something. No. The computer software is showing, look, this is happening. And you can't fake that. It's software, it's equipment, it doesn't care.
And you mentioned a lot of the, a lot of the science is also based around the neuro, the brain, seeing signals in the brain.
Yeah.
And yet I've heard a lot of, or I've read a lot of material that suggests that actually a lot of the emotional stuff, the brain of the body is more like the heart. And you mentioned earlier that the field of the heart is much bigger than the field.
Oh, the heart has a much more powerful effect. It's called an afferent communication because it is going up from the heart into the brain. But the brain-heart issue is huge. I mean, basically what happens is we have thoughts, we generate thoughts, and when we generate enough of those thoughts in our brain, we transfer them into our heart, and then they become firmly held beliefs.
Okay.
And it's our beliefs that do the damage. You can think you're rubbish, but the moment you believe you're rubbish, that's a completely different thing. You can think you're awesome without any evidence, but the moment you believe you're awesome, it's a completely different thing. And again, there's so many studies to support this. Again, the evidence base is there, totally.
So what you're saying is like the actual idea, the very thought of being rubbish is in the brain, but actually the minute there's emotion laid on top of it, that's the stuff that comes from the heart. And that's a physical thing that you can kind of detect, the scientists can look
you
at.
Can. So it's, what happens then is you've got you're no longer then in a coherent state. There's a mismatch between both your heart and your head. They're not in balance. So your autonomic nervous system comes in, your heart starts to speed up, you start to produce more adrenaline, your sympathetic nervous system, your eyes will dilate because there's a fear response. You have to stop that. And you can do that very, very quickly. I've created another technique, which is literally just tap your bottom lip.
Okay.
That stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system. Just literally drum your fingers on your bottom lip, stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, which counters the sympathetic nervous system trying to act up. And then what happens there is, you can't pump the adrenaline, your pupils contract, you begin to salivate more so you don't have the dry mouth thing, your blood pressure regulates, and basically it knocks on the head panic attacks.
Really? So if you're going through a panic moment,
tap on your bottom lip.
Just tap,
simple
drum your bottom lip with two, three of your fingers?
Just two or three fingers. Roll your fingers along your bottom lip and just tap on that. I will be putting a YouTube up on it at some point.
Okay.
But it's so easy. And again, we know what's happening. There's some vasovagal stimulation on. The vagus nerve gets stimulated, which kind of comes, it's an afferent nerve, comes up the front of the body again. And you also produce more nitrous oxide, which is a vasodilator, so your blood pressure drops and there's lots of evidence behind it.
So is that when you're in the middle of the panic attack? Do you have to be thinking about what's, or can it be if you've got something coming up and you can sort of do it in advance?
Yeah,
or
do it prophylactically, just head it off at the pass, just tap on your lip.
Okay.
Simple as that.
Brilliant.
And the warmth of the oxytocin, the figure of eight in your forehead, dump some oxytocin out into your system. And if the cortisol tries to get in there, there's no space for it.
Yeah.
There's no room for it.
Because I've been doing a lot of reading and studying on the sort of the pregnancy aspect, and oxytocin is quite a shy hormone from what I've gathered.
But it's produced in copious amounts.
Is it?
Yeah.
So you can literally just flood your system with it.
Absolutely. I mean, people buy it over the counter.
Yeah.
You can snort it. You can literally snort oxytocin. However, the body produces more than enough than what you need. You just need to know how to access it.
Yeah,
that's all.
I remember you gave me that technique when I was waiting when to bring on my little daughter, and I was swishing my forehead with the number eight.
And literally, you put your fingers in the middle of your forehead, you trace this figure of eight, this lazy eight.
Yeah.
Count to 20, 30 while you do it, depending on the speed at which you're doing it. And then just, you know, open your eyes and try and think stressful thoughts. And you can't, because there's no room for stress. You're flooded with oxytocin. The cortisol's kind of going, well, I've got nowhere to go. It's stuck. It's like it can't activate because there's no space for it to activate.
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
Yeah.
So you've let's just talk a bit more about the technique that you've come up with, which you've called PsyTap.
Called PsyTap, Psychosensory Techniques and Principles.
So okay.
People think it's just about tapping. It's not. It's the techniques and principles. So I'm going to teach the techniques and the principles underlying it around psychosensory input. Psychosensory input is, smell, touch, taste, our kinesthetics and what we hear. It's all auditory input. That gets transduced neurologically into emotional states. We hear... Yeah, if you're driving and you're playing heavy rock and then you change channels to classic rock, classic music from classic rock to classic music, your driving habits will change completely.
Mm.
And again, this is stuff that can be measured. You can wire people up to heart rate monitors, you can wire them up to blood pressure machines, to pulse oximeters, and there are definite physiological changes that happen just by changing music.
Mm.
That's it. It's as simple as that. So driving starts changing. You tend to be a lot more sedentary and more relaxed. We react to things, you see a fluffy sort of kitten on YouTube and then again you see something absolutely horrible happen, and again it's not happening to you, you're seeing it vicariously, but you have a reaction almost as though it's happening to you. You have this limbic based paleo-ancestral caveman response as to it's a perceived threat. Very much a perceived threat.
And so your technique is sort of blending, is addressing all of that.
Yeah, as I say, I've been mentored. I've been very luckily mentored by some absolutely brilliant people, and I've kind of looked at almost like picking the best of the best. It's like, now that's what I call good therapy. Album 24.
Yeah,
I'm picking the best bits of all the best bits, and cherry picking. And also looking at what I've created and the theories behind it, and then using the evidence-based network that we've got with the HeartMath and with a few other things that we've got to show that it's working, it's doing what I'm saying it's doing. So,
yeah.
And I'm sure later on down the road, if we could ever get to a clinical trial stage, then we could do cortisol swabs and we could do saliva swabs and get cortisol values if we needed to. We already suspect what's going on, but that's...
So what kind of things, to somebody that may be not familiar with a lot of the things that these techniques can help with, just for those that sort of, might be struggling with something like depression or severe stress, what kind of things could this method help?
Depression is a different thing. Depression is kind of diagnosed on a tick list now. I've, over the last 12 years, probably seen 600 people for depression, of which probably only 7 or 8 have depression.
Right.
It's misdiagnosed ridiculously because people fit certain criteria and metrics on a GP's form. So they get given an antidepressant and therefore, by default, they're depressed. Whereas quite often they're not. It's chronic anxiety or a trauma that needs releasing. But no, we can deal with levels of depression to some degree, or depressive tendencies and moods. Anxiety, stresses, fears, phobias, physical pain. Most physical pain, according to John Sarno, some 30 years ago, most physical pain is trapped stress and anger and other emotions that manifest itself in a somatic form in our body to distract us from the emotional pain. We have a physical pain to distract it. If it's a real pain that's meant to be there, you won't get rid of it. If it's a referred pain, or if it's a non-physicality pain, then you can get rid of it, because then that's an emotional issue. It's an emotional pain. John Sarno, who's a medical doctor in New York, was positing these theories 30 years ago. And like all things, initially he was ridiculed. Like all truth, initially it's ridiculed. Then it's accepted, and then it's seen as self-evident. They're the three stages that, that it goes through, and it's like, oh yeah, of course, we know that now. Well, yeah, this guy was saying this 30 years ago.
But even now, I think a lot of that is still dismissed quite a lot. Yeah, you know, when I talk about, I've shared a lot on the podcast when I've experienced certain symptoms, it's like, well, what's the trapped emotion there? Let's release the trapped emotion. You can relieve the physical symptoms. And still people are like, well, that sounds a little bit woo-woo to me. And so you're saying that actually there's a lot of evidence behind...
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is science is catching up with woo-woo.
Yeah.
in a nutshell. Science and woo-woo. One day we'll meet and shake hands and kind of go, actually. there's a great phrase, you know, what... you know, science is the yoga of the West, you know, whereas yoga is the science of the East.
Yeah.
And it's just that. Again, it's that
figure of eight.
And eventually they will meet in the middle. They will hit what they call the vertex point and meet and kind of go, ooh, actually, neither of us are wrong.
No.
We're actually both right.
And, just looking at it from different sides.
Yeah.
So have you got any favourite approaches? Are there ones that you just love using just because you're really comfortable with them or... Are you driven by, I know I'm going to bring use this because it works?
I tend to use what works. Even if I've got to sometimes resort back to using, well, I use hypnosis a lot, just linguistically, but you know, and I use NLP linguistically without trying to do it as a form technique. It's just, you know, Richard Bandler once said to me, Richard mentored me quite closely, and he sort of said, you can't do NLP. You can't do NLP. You have to be NLP.
Okay.
And I kind of get that. If it's not in your core, you know, then it's manipulative. And people don't like manipulation, which is why a lot of people don't like NLP. They sort of say it's manipulative. That's because the people doing it are manipulating and they're not very good at it. You know, they need to do a few more courses or, you know, study with the right people.
You just like to use what works.
I use whatever works for the right client at the right time. Occasionally, I'll get them going into like weird stuff like, you know, spontaneous past life regression and things like that.
Yeah.
And I'm trained to do that. I've done POR.
Yeah.
Did the course. Well, you only live once. So. but you know, it's fun stuff to do. That's why I love this stuff. You know, that there are no two clients. So people, you know, people are like snowflakes. They're all different. They're not the same. And you treat everyone individually and differently. You can't presuppose that somebody's going to react in a certain way to a certain technique because they either will or they won't. And if they don't, then you have to have a big toy box. I don't call them tools because that implies work. It's more play for me. So a big toy box, so you can pull the right toy out and you know, get the right result. It's all about initially, I think, sort of Frankl's stimulus response. In Viktor Frankl, in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, said, you know, there's a moment between stimulus and response where all negative things occur. And all you've really got to do is open up that gap, widen the gap, so you can just make a more informed, more rational, better choice.
And it seems to me the whole field of working to improve our performance and really tackle the emotional, mental piece within us has really moved on significantly in the last 50 years or so. And certainly when NLP came out, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And do you think sort of some of the, you know, that provided a really great foundation for a lot of the work today? Do you think NLP compared to what we see today is still delivering the kind of results? Or do you think there's other bodies of work that are now built on that that kind of are almost... not better, because I don't like to use effective.
I'm a master trainer and practitioner of NLP, and I've trained with both Richard Bandler and John Grinder and a few other people. NLP was initially created because it looked at excellent things, modelled them, looked at the epistemological process, that, you know, how does that work, why does that work? And then it stopped doing that. It created its own system, and it's kind of stopped doing that now. John Grinder's done some work with New Code and everything, but... Yeah, you know, I've had many people really high up in the NLP sort of world sort of look at TFT, which works elegantly and works hand in glove very, very well with NLP, and they dismiss it. They'll dismiss it and say it's just collapsing anchors, despite all the evidence against that. And whether it's because they feel threatened because something's come out that's more powerful or appears more effective, then I don't know. But I'd probably say it's a threat base. It's, I mean, I've created some NLP techniques of my own that I've developed and shown them to people. And do they kind of go, oh, that's great, and embrace it? No, they completely ignore it. And they'll go back to using, you know, a six-step reframe or a swish pattern, which, incidentally, if you give a client a swish pattern to go home with, and expect them to do it. You live in a fantasy land. It's too complex. You know, people want simplicity.
Yeah.
People want now. We live in a society that's a now society now. Yeah. We want, you know, Amazon Prime, just-in-time stuff.
Yeah.
Next day delivery, instant messages, email. We don't live in a long term. That's why you know, that's why the more you can deliver this, I can fix you now.
Yeah.
Stuff is really powerful.
And why do you think, I mean, some of the techniques that you're talking about, you know, like NLP and TFT and hypnosis and some of the new energy techniques as well that are really quite powerful. There seems to be like there's a lot of people out there that could really do with some of this. You know, like when you think about PTSD, some of the veterans, for example, that come back from fighting the wars, that are really kind of missing out on experiencing the magic that comes from healing, experiencing healing. And you hear these people that are living with these traumas that don't seem to know about them. What's that about?
I'm not going to go down the sort of conspiracy route all around the farms, but, you know, the government is restricted by what can go through the NICE protocols, you know, the National Institute of Clinical Health and Excellence. And unfortunately, you know, unfortunately, CBT has ticked those boxes. Even though the efficacy is proven to be very, very poor, it ticks those boxes. And people sort of say, well, yeah, evidence-based, you know, all pharmaceuticals have got an evidence base behind them. Yeah, they do. But however, I don't know if you know, but if you do 20 trials on the drug, and 19 of them show that the drug isn't doing what it says it's doing, but one does, they only have to publish the one that does.
Yeah.
They can ignore the other 19. If they don't like the data they get, they just don't publish it. So it's very, very selective what they sort of pick out of this. So, so yeah, stats, you know, there's lies down lies and statistics. So that's what we're trying to do is show with our evidence base, it's not numbers, it's the physicality, it's not. You know, the human body right now in this moment in time is showing you that a change is occurring. And once we've got enough of that data together, we'll compile it. And a lot of people say, well, it's just anecdotes. And I quote Einstein that once said, if you have enough anecdotes, you've got evidence.
Yeah. And so what about people that work in this field that struggle, that might have potential clients come into them saying, you know, that they're throwing the science argument at them. If there's a lot of people working out there doing that kind of change work, what kind of advice would you give people like that to help them get their work out, to reach the people they know they could really...
Okay.
Have you got any advice to people like that? Because you've clearly made a real success out of your business and reaching
come
people.
Come and cite that. No, it's not a sales pitch. No, it's good. It's good structure. It's not that laborious. It's a four-day training. And a lot of fun. No, actually... If somebody really does want to go, I just say, well, then keep your problem. If you want to keep it, you know, you've got all the evidence you need that, you know, you're messed up and you're screwed up and, you know, life sucks, then keep that and keep your evidence base that supports that. However, when you're ready to sort of let go of all that, whether it's woo-woo or not, or I can show you, then come and see me.
Yeah.
You can't force these people to, you know, to be fixed if they don't want to. I mean, just talking about the PTSD thing, I was about to go and do, with the blessing of Prince Charles, the Colonel-in-Chief, the family's officer, the Welsh Guards when they came up from Afghanistan, knowing that they're never going to go back out there again. And at the 11th hour, I had the plug pulled on me by this psychiatrist.
Really?
Yeah, he said, no, it's not going to happen. Everybody else is up for it, psychiatrist, no, not going to happen.
So it seems to me like there is the people that have trained in psychology, the kind of the traditional people that maybe spent 4+ years training in their field are maybe sort of guarding their sector, their
industry.
Maybe
they make a bit of money out of that, so, you know, maybe that's a motivation. Maybe it's not, I'm not saying it is, it's just a suggestion I might drop in. But it makes you question why, when something is shown repeatedly to work over and over and over and over again, why they don't look at it, at least scratch their head and go... Yeah. Let me find out a bit more about that.
And certainly when you hear about, certainly here in the UK, when you've got the NHS that's struggling with all the drugs that they're spending, haven't got enough money, and most of that money is spent on the drugs, and yet the major cause of
is... No, there again, so you've got a strange dichotomy. If we were to apply, for example, our technology that we have in our web-based app, Steve and I actually did a study once based on some of the numbers that we had from GP... data that we had, that we showed that we could save, if we did our worst job, we could save the NHS $1.6 billion a year.
Right.
Our worst job.
On a good day.
If we did what we thought we could do, we're looking somewhere between 3.8 to 4.2 billion, somewhere in that range. However, if we did that, what would then be there is there will be a hole, because people would be using the pharmaceuticals anymore, and there will be an 11 to 15 billion pound hole that our savings don't fill.
Oh, really? What, you mean in the economy? Or
Same with smoking. That's why it's... Yeah. There's far too much tax revenue from cigarettes to be offset by the savings in the NHS. It's a bad economical model. As harsh as that sounds, it's a bad economical model.
So basically it pays the government to keep us ill. Bottom line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if we all live longer, what's that going to do with the pension pot?
Yeah. So they kind of want us to cark it.
I'm not saying that directly. It's a suggestion. Yeah. It's a thought. It's just a thought.
It's an interesting idea.
Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not going down the company of the Illuminati. I'm not David Icke, so I'm not going down that sort of, you know. Atterbury does say some very profound things when you look at some of his evidence again. But no, it is what it is. All I can do, you know, I could die tomorrow, the world isn't going to fall apart because Kevin lays up here. All I can do is make the difference I can make as and when I can make it right now. And if people want to join me on the journey, then that'll be great.
Yeah, brilliant. So if, Kevin, people do want to join you in this journey and follow you and follow your work, where can I find out more about you?
Okay, well, there's a couple of websites. One is my own personal, KevinLay, LAYE.co.uk. Mm. Or you can YouTube, there's lots of things on there. And the other one, the new one, is SciTap. It's PSY-TAP.com. And there, if you just go on and say that you've got an interest in it, we'll send you a download that's worth £12-13.
Oh, brilliant.
Of course, shall we transfer you? You can get that off there. We're not going to bombard you and hit you with landing pages and emails. My admin skills aren't that good at that. I hate doing that anyway. So I hate it happening to me, so I don't want to do it to other people. Mm-hmm. So no, it's good fun. If you want to join the family or join the little cast of Jedi warriors that I have.
Fantastic.
Then yeah.
And your next train, you've got some new trainings coming up.
Yeah, I've probably got a training. It will probably be early or mid-May.
Okay.
It's my guess. Worst case, June, but it'll be sort of mid-year.
Okay.
Yeah, I've just completed one with my first group. And then after that, the next one will be a small training, sort of 12 or 14 people again, which will be my last sort of run through, and then after that I'm handing it over to an agent in London who's going to be getting bigger numbers. However, it'll be a lot more expensive. So if you want a deal, contact me and do this next one.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Kevin. Great. It's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Now, wasn't that really, really interesting? I hope you enjoyed listening to that as much as I enjoyed chatting to Kevin. Now, while we spoke, he shared so much really great information. But if you want to find out more about his SciTap trainings, then the link is in the podcast show notes. And you can also check out his website as well. All the details are within the show notes. Now, also, Kevin, during our chat, he said that he was going to give away a free audio. And that audio is the Banish Stress audio. And if you want a free download link for that audio, then again, you can find that within the podcast show notes on the Head Trash website. So if you just go to headtrash.co.uk/Kevin, and you'll find all the details that you need on that web page, and that'll be there for you to just download absolutely free. That audio that he's giving away is normally retailing for just under £13 UK pounds, so that's about $15. So you can get that absolutely free as a listener to the Head Trash Show podcast. So massive thanks to Kevin. So I hope that you got a lot out of that, and I will see you guys next time on the Head Trash Show podcast. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in. You've just been listening to Alexia Leachman here on the Head Trash Show. If you enjoyed the show, she'd really appreciate you leaving a review on iTunes. And don't forget to pop over to www.headtrash.co.uk to get your copy of the free 5 Steps to Clearing Head Trash guide. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes for more strategies, tips, and how-tos for clearing your head trash and reclaiming your headspace. Until next time.